It's not about getting the right plan. It's about understanding how a student qualifies and what that means. Pour a cup of coffee. Today, we're going to talk about the IEP evaluation process. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Special Ed, IEPs, 504s, oh my, Conversations with DCCEC. I'm Meredith. I have Tasha here with me.
Hi there.
Welcome to part one of our three-part segment series. Today, we're getting the breakdown from our experts who understand the intersection of learning and well-being. Joining us are Dr. Stephanie Crawford, Director of Mental Health, Dr. Bernadette Pidgeon, Mental Health Coordinator, and Ellen Kirchhoff, Mental Health Lead. They're here to help us decode the eval process and understand the key role mental health plays.
I'm Ellen Kirchhoff, Mental Health Team Lead for the district. I coach, mentor, and support our school psychologists and social workers.
I'm Dr. Bernadette Pidgeon, the Mental Health Coordinator for the district. I work closely with our psychs and social workers and also part of our crisis team and do professional development and case consultation.
Hi, I'm Dr. Stephanie Crawford, Director of Mental Health for the district. I oversee our mental health team, supporting kids with mental health concerns and special education needs, psychological safety, and our crisis response.
Thank you so much for being here today. What are common signs a student might need an evaluation beyond academic struggles?
The first thing that comes to mind is that behavioral struggles look like externalizing behaviors where there are things that are disrupting class or somebody else's access to learning. And then really important to watch for the internalizers who might be having struggles that are less easy to see.
Do you have examples?
Students with anxiety or depression symptoms sometimes, it's not as obvious. They may shut down rather than doing things that can easily be seen. They might avoid school.
Yeah, and I will add to that, when you're looking at our students, depending on the timing of the year too, if you're seeing students who are struggling and they've had significant changes in how they are behaving at school, or parents are saying they have some changes in their behaviors at home as well, that's a good indication that maybe those parents in the school need to consider, is there something more going on than maybe just for that moment in time? If it's been happening and you start to see struggles.
I have a child on a 504 and a child on an IEP. Sometimes from a mom experience, some of those behaviors may be frustration of some of the disabilities. So my question is, I'm assuming that you guys collaborate with the teams. They all work together?
Absolutely. Yeah.
We tell a strong RTI process and working with the multidisciplinary team within the special education department, then also with our counselors. We're lucky to have counselors in all our buildings.
How do parents or kids initiate the formal referral or request evaluation?
Parents can email, whether it's the general education teacher or it's an email to administration or anybody in the school team saying, I would like to request special education evaluation, and also a reason why. These are my concerns. Just make sure it's in writing. General education teachers who also start to see that too and can also bring it up into the counselor for an MTSS evaluation or process, get them involved in that. And then the general education teacher can also bring that up. And then the special education team would take that and go to the parents.
So they go to the parent before and say, we're noticing these things, or is there a conversation amongst everyone first before the parents when a teacher is noticing it?
When the teacher is noticing it, if they should be in communication with the parents, say, we are noticing this, bring it up to the rest of the team. There would be a conversation with parents before a referral meeting, just like the parent request.
Okay. When looking at the school side, we encourage teachers to try things when they notice a student might need extra support, partner with the parent and keep them in the know, work with their team counselor, psychologist or social worker, depending on the concern, to say, I might need extra help with supports. But the school side of things, we're going to want to see, is this a student who maybe just doesn't have some of the skills yet, or there's a strategy we could put in place or an environmental adaptation for their learning environment? If they continue to struggle, that's when they would say, we need to elevate this to a special education referral process. A parent would be looped in and be in the know, a part of that process. Whereas Bernadette was saying with the parent, though, if they have a concern, they should speak with their counselor or someone else on the team, and definitely their principals. Make sure they're communicating concerns and advocating for their child.
A teacher has come to a parent concerned, you probably need to go to the doctor and get a diagnosis. Do you have suggestions or go to these people to start this discussion?
We collaborate with our health, wellness, and prevention team, the counselors that are a part of, and our school nurses and our prevention staff working with all students. And so they've been working to make sure our staff know when you have a concern, here are your people at the school level that you can go to ask for a consultation, strategy ideas, before thinking that a student might need an evaluation. So that's something that the district's been working on with this team and our team. And we're educating all our staff about what to do when you have a worry and who can you go and talk to.
What's the difference between a psychoeducational evaluation and assessments like speech language or OT?
Those are part of a psychoeducational assessment.
Really?
Yeah. Sometimes speech can be case managers. So there are times where there might be a psychoeducational evaluation that consists mostly of speech. OT, mental health providers, do not serve as case managers. So there could be times where they're doing a special evaluation just to see if their services are needed on an existing IEP.
Okay.
It depends on the concern is. We're trying to make sure that we're doing a comprehensive job of assessing what's going on with any particular student, so that we know how we can best support them.
Is it during the evaluation that you are figuring out what you're evaluating for, or are you getting feedback from teachers before the evaluation to see what the areas are for concern?
It's driven by concern. There's something called a referral question driving the evaluation, and it should be driving what assessments are planned. Sometimes we find things out during an evaluation that might make us change that plan a bit.
Okay.
Individualized evaluations can look really different from student to student because their needs may be different.
And what would be an example of a referral question?
Potentially being evaluated for special education due to reading concerns or behavioral challenges.
Concerns, or perhaps families get a diagnosis and they're wondering how this impacts them at school. That can be a referral question. And we can take that and be like, we're actually not seeing any signs of that at school. Or, oh, yes, that makes sense. We're seeing signs of this at school. We do want to move forward with an evaluation.
It's fluid. Then it sounds like you're evaluating and you can see maybe other struggles or not. And then you did touch on a family getting a diagnosis. I feel like a lot of parents start there because they don't know to start at the school level. Can you explain the difference between the diagnosis and an educational diagnosis?
Yeah, absolutely. In schools, we don't diagnose. We find students eligible under different categories of special education. And within those categories, there are some things that sound like diagnosis. So for example, there are 13 different eligibility categories. One is autism, ASD. Eligibility. So what we're doing is we're just understanding if there are symptoms of autism for that specific one that are impacting the educational environment. We never say your student has ADHD or autism. We'd say they have symptoms in the educational environment. Our CDE license says we're not diagnosticians.
I could give you a real life example as a parent with a child that has ADHD. When he was young, he was in preschool doing okay. There were some signs, though, that he was having difficulties. And when I went to my pediatrician, she had indicated I'm worried a little bit about his speech articulation and then also some behavioral things. Speaking with her and teachers, we went with a medical diagnosis because he was doing okay in preschool. We did child find and he did need the speech services. But then as time evolved and he got into elementary school, he began experiencing more learning and behavioral challenges. The school had brought up doing a special education evaluation to see if he might benefit from services. Other times it might be a parent is noticing maybe a few struggles, but maybe they don't know. This is their first child and the staff are noticing struggles different than their peer. They'll let the parents know we have a concern, we're monitoring, we're trying things. And then eventually that leads to that special education evaluation. And from there, for example, if it's something like ADHD or autism, the parent may also work with their physician. I would like medical diagnosis in addition to the educational eligibility, wrapping around my child both educationally at school, but also medically to make sure I'm getting all of the support and treatments available.
I agree. Conversations I get from parents is, I'm noticing this. What should I do? Or they get the medical diagnosis and they're like, oh, I don't know if it would impact them at school.
A lot of times when I talk to parents, they get a medical diagnosis and then they get the diagnosis. Sometimes their brain almost stops there. They think, like, we've done this diagnosis, now we're here. But I think it was really enlightening what you said, is that's just part of it, right? Like, you're treating your child as an individual. That diagnosis is part of their overall person, integrated with their learning. Sometimes people stop with the diagnosis, one piece of the puzzle.
From the school perspective, it's about whether education and access to education are being impacted. We're supporting kids with that educational piece and providing good resources and conversations around what other supports might be available.
Would you recommend a parent to go to a physician for a medical diagnosis, or is that stepping over a line?
That'd be stepping over a line. And we have asked parents, have you considered a medical diagnosis, or is there a medical diagnosis, just that we have a full picture of the student? But we're really concerned about that educational impact. And that's where we stay within our scope of practice.
We are open to saying, if you have questions and need community resources, we're happy to share guides so that you have all the information you need if you want to consider other things outside of school. But as we've said, we would never tell a parent you need to, or we're recommending it or requiring you to go and do something like that.
Sometimes it is helpful to know that information collected at school is helpful to the medical profession, because they aren't seeing a kid at school. They're not able to observe how teachers and other students and other people in the school environment are experiencing what's going on with that student.
My son's going through an evaluation for ADHD right now, and I'm doing it at the same time. I gave the doctor the evaluation, and I'm like, oh, he really needs that observation. So he gets the full picture having that observation. This is what's actually going on.
That brings up an important point, is that we should never be basing everything on one piece of information. It's really important to get multiple sources and perspectives, and making sure we're looking at the whole child.
I think we get a lot of ADHD like parent concerns, but do you do an evaluation and then do you determine this is IEP or falls under the 504?
There are times to do special education testing depending on the information that comes from that and what we're finding. Is there special education needs or not, it then could be brought up like there may be not the need to change programming and have those level of services, but there are still needs that the student has demonstrated. And so we might then look at a 504. Other times it's apparent that we start with a 504 evaluation and the student seems to need more just accommodations versus a full special education evaluation. The pathways can be different depending on every case.
I think a lot of parents don't feel a 504 is always enough.
I think you bring up a good point. One of the myths about 504s and IEPs is that IEPs are the better thing to have. And it really is dependent on your child's need. They are both great. They just serve different purposes. They both protect children who have disabilities, but they are under different laws. The types of supports can be different. If the concern is one more where the parent or the teacher are saying they're doing okay, but they are struggling, and we think that these accommodations would help, that's where they might start. Let's start with a 504 plan and see how that goes. Maybe on the 504 plan, they're still struggling and they actually needed more than just accommodations. So then they would say, we need to look at a special education evaluation. The district's been working hard on making sure all of our schools have problem-solving teams or response to intervention teams, that RTI that we've talked about, where they're looking at the student as a team with the parent from the very initial concern and then trying things to see which evaluation would be better and make sure we get it right the first time.
I like this RTI team. Can you explain more about this RTI? That's a huge comfort to parents to hear about
that. Yeah. So in our training in mental health, we're trained that when there's a concern brought up about a child or a person, to look outside of that person and child before we decide that there's something internally wrong with them and they have a disability. Through these problem-solving teams, these response to intervention teams, staff members are looking at different concerns for the child and trying things. It might be something simple like, we just need to change the environment. There's something in the classroom that's not working for the child. we make that change and that's helpful. It might be working with the parents to know something has been happening medically with the child. Mm-hmm. Like maybe the child is having sleep issues. Mm-hmm. And the school says we're concerned about attention. And people might be thinking ADHD, but we learn they're not sleeping. So they work with their physician and they get the sleeping problem taken care of. I've had a case where we were worried about attention, but the parent was giving them Benadryl every day for allergies. They work with their doctor for a non-drowsy medication. But there are times we're working with parents and students. They changed the classroom. The parent, they checked with their physician that there wasn't some medical issue that they needed to address. And we're trying strategies. The child is still struggling. So now we need to consider an evaluation and see if they have a disability.
And the RTI, is that response to intervention?
That is
correct. Who's involved in that team? Is it a fluid team or certain members?
It's different per building, typically, but not always, depending on who has the capacity. Our counselors are usually involved because it is considered a tier two intervention. A counselor, maybe somebody from special education, a general education teacher can sometimes be a part of that team, and an administrator would be the typical makeup of that team, but it all depends. And different schools do it different ways, depending on what system works best. They'll keep track of interventions of progress or decline.
Sometimes they will make up different names. In education is the multi-tiered system of supports framework. In our district and others, we're now saying integrated MTSS. We're making sure we're encompassing every aspect of school. Not as a framework where all of the things we do in education exist among these tiers, like universal, tier one, at risk, tier two, intensive, tier three. And people will sometimes call them MTSS teams or IMTSS teams. These teams that meet often weekly take concerns by teachers about students to see how can we help them. And a good team will have a multidisciplinary approach. You have a team member who can do academic interventions. If it's behavioral or emotional, you have teammates that can do that. Each time they meet, they're looking at the progress data for their students. Do they stay in this process because they're making progress? Do they get to leave because they learn the skill, or do they need an evaluation?
Some schools call them problem-solving teams.
Those teams are within the building. Is it every student or just students with teachers that have concerns about that kid?
I think just students that have concerns surrounding them are brought to that process, because everyone gets universal tier one intervention, like counselors doing bullying lessons or social emotional lessons that are within the classroom. But if there's more of a concern, then they get into that tier two, which is some sort of intervention, behavioral or social emotional or academic, before they move into the tier three.
Is all that information communicated with the parent? Can they ask for that information?
They should be in communication with it. The tier one, they're probably getting in the school or classroom newsletter. Parents should be involved in that RTI process.
When you're doing your assessments, functional or psychoeducational, where do you do them? How do you observe them? Who do you interview? How do you collect that information to get that whole student picture?
We have support around special education evaluation for our providers. They're called body of evidence documents. Those documents help everybody consider all the areas that a really fully individualized comprehensive evaluation would include. That doesn't mean it's prescriptive. It doesn't mean that has to be included for every student being evaluated, because again, the referral question and the concern are driving things, but it makes sure that people are at least considering and can articulate maybe why or why not they wouldn't do a certain element. Some elements are always done. We're always checking vision and hearing. You don't want to get to the end of an evaluation and find that somebody wasn't seeing well, and then all your test results are invalidated. We're always doing certain things. We're usually at least considering interviews with parent, student, teachers. We're usually thinking about what the concern is and then targeting our assessments to make sure that we're gathering the appropriate information. We're usually trying to observe in more than one setting. So that could be academic versus social, or preferred task versus non-preferred tasks, or any combination of them. Some of our psychoeducational evaluations, especially when I'm thinking about educational ID of autism or significant emotional disability, may have other components that we like to make sure are in there. With our autism evaluations, we like to make sure there are some joint observations, so people are looking at the same thing from different lenses. That's often going to be our speech-language pathologist and our mental health provider, or speech with a teacher.
The special education team has the information, what the parents' concerns are, the school's concerns, any of that response to intervention data. They're able to look at that and say, based on the concerns and what we know about this child, these are the areas that need to be evaluated. And then that will be put into that evaluation consent form that's shared with the parent at a meeting to say, based on the concerns that we've all been talking about, we want to go forward with an evaluation. These are the areas. The parent has an opportunity to ask questions about that and sign form consent that, yes, I agree, I would like to have this evaluation in those areas.
Is it still fluid for the re-evaluation every 3 years? Are you going off old information from the first evaluation or starting a new evaluation with a new lens, open-minded with some information to back it up?
If it's the same concern and people aren't thinking a different eligibility needs to be considered, then we might be reviewing old information, but still collect adequate new information to have a complete picture of the present for that child. And sometimes that might just be confirming then for us that we're on the right track and continue addressing needs. It also gives us the opportunity to see what's changed. Kids 3 years apart, especially in elementary, but even elementary to middle and then middle to high, those developmental needs can look really different. So it's important to make sure we are looking at the whole child and collecting data to be sure we're doing a comprehensive evaluation each time.
If you get information from an outside speech doctor or therapist, do you use those for your inputs to get a better picture?
Yeah, I think we'll always want to see that and consider it as a piece of information that goes with everything else we're collecting. It's important to have information from multiple sources and perspectives. Information from home is super important. Sometimes we're seeing things at school that aren't happening at home and vice versa. All those pieces are huge to make sure we're looking at the big picture.
With outside reports, depending on when they're done, we may just be reviewing that information because we don't do certain assessments within the same time period. If a parent already went through an outside evaluation and did 3 or 4 or 6 questionnaires, and then 6 months later, they're going to the school and the school's like, we're going to reevaluate. We're not going to ask you to do those same questionnaires within a certain time period. One, because it wouldn't be valid because you're so familiar with the questions, depending on the time period. And two, because it is a lot of work. And so in that, we'll focus on current data from the school and then reviewing the data from the outside evaluation.
One of the most helpful things when working with students is helping them understand if they have some differences in how their brain might work. Students with ADHD or neurodiverse students, or all of us have differences really in how our brain works. Understanding your own brain, body, and needs is a huge part of it. And no matter what bucket you're pulling from, everybody's got different needs and may need different buckets.
Special education sometimes has a stigma.
I would say it's really good for the parent and the providers to talk to the students about their disability and how it impacts them, because it shouldn't be a stigma and that I'm less than.
I want to say thank you to our guests today. Please join us for part 2 and 3 of this segment. In part 2, we're going to be talking a little bit more about that 3-year evaluation process, as well as the IEP meeting and some advice for parents. And then in the last part of the series, we're going to be talking about functional behavior assessments and some really exciting news that the district wanted to share with us. We shared resources throughout this podcast segment. We're going to put those in the show notes, so be sure to check there for any resources that have been mentioned. You can also learn more about DCCEC on our social media or go to our webpage, dccec.org. If you like this podcast, please like, share, follow, and let other parents know about us. We're just trying to get conversations out there. If you have any suggestions, definitely let us know on those social medias or even at info@dccec.org. That's our email. We're really excited. We have lots of conversations that are coming up. So until next time, bye.